This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
There's very little doubt that white privilege is a thing. How much of a thing is the big question. While some parents say they are raising colorblind children, they could be ignoring opportunities to teach tolerance.
Children do notice race, and then they're very confused about why they can't talk about it. You know, parents kind of shushing their child when their child asks a question about race.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear from a sociologist whose long-term study is the topic of the new book called White Kids. Then we'll hear from a consumer advocate about toxic chemicals found in some common back-to-school items. And we'll spend an academic minute finding toxins in the dirt in your backyard. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Yes, racism in America is still a thing. And yes, there are some people who will argue that point with you. And then there are some who are growing up while it's happening all around them. Margaret Hagerman is an assistant professor of sociology at Mississippi State University. She moved to a city in the Midwest and conducted an extensive study on the topic with upper-middle-class students and their parents. The result is the new book called White Kids, Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. I spoke to Dr. Hagerman about this project and asked how she got started.
So when I was in graduate school, I was reading all kinds of really interesting research about the ways that families raising children of color prepare their kids to live in a society where their kids may experience discrimination or racism. And as I was reading this really important work, I was thinking a lot about how it is that white children learn about race and racism also within the context of their own families. And so I decided that I would pursue a research project on this topic, and that has now resulted in my new book, White Kids.
So where did you find the kids? Where did you do this study?
So this research was conducted in a medium-sized Midwestern community. I moved to this community. I did not live there previous to the research. And I started just spending time in spaces where the kinds of parents that I wanted to interview spent time, so places like yoga studios and restaurants and cafes. And the families in my study are all white, and they're all also upper middle class. And so they have wealth, and they have occupations that, you know, give them good salaries and so forth, high levels of education. And so I started building relationships with people, and then parents would connect me with other parents, and I sort of built my sample out from there.
Did you contact any schools while you were doing this?
I did not. So this was a family-based project. So although I learned a lot about the schools, and I did do some informal interviews with people who worked in the school system, some of the parents even were, you know, working in the schools, I did not actually go into any schools.
As you were talking and doing these interviews, did you get the idea that you were getting a lot of sincerity? And a lot of people feel, you know, there are things they have to say about race.
Absolutely. So one of the things that we know in social science research is that surveys, while they can be really helpful in documenting like broad trends, sometimes when we interview or when we survey white people, they don't give you their honest responses, just like you're saying. They feel like they need to say something so they don't get judged or whatever. And so I think what was really great about my project is that I actually spent time and built relationships with the people in my study. And so I built a lot of rapport and trust. And I do believe that I was able to really access their honest opinions. And I mean, they told me things like, I wouldn't tell you this if you weren't a white person, or, you know, it's important to me that I know you, or those kinds of things. And they also, you know, we would get into, you know, it's not arguments, but, you know, they would really defend their positions, and they knew that their positions sometimes weren't popular. So I do feel like I was able to really get at what they truly believed.
Before, there's one thing for the parents, before the kids, is racism seen as a real thing for them or just stuff you see on TV?
One of the things that I was really struck by in my research is actually the variation in what these children thought. And I was surprised by that because they're all living in the same community. They all are white. They all have the same class background. But actually, I found that there was some variation in what these children thought about things like racism and privilege and inequality. And so certainly one group of the kids told me that racism was over. There's no such thing as racism in America anymore. Racism was a problem from the past and so on. But that wasn't the only position that that kids articulated to me. Some of the other children talked about things like institutional racism, and they talked about, they didn't use this language, but they talked about like the racial wealth gap. They talked about inequality in their schools. They talked about, you know, their perceptions of how the police treated them versus their friends of color. And so I think there's actually a lot more variation than I anticipated in what the kids thought.
In the end, did you see that neighborhood, what neighborhood they live in, probably means more than either parenting or schooling?
I do think that neighborhood is really important because I talk about in the book this idea of bundled choices. So when parents make a decision, and these are parents that have wealth status, you know, they have lots of money, and so they're able to make decisions about which neighborhood to live in. And when you make a decision about a neighborhood, you're also often making decisions about other things, like what school your children will attend, or who your neighbors will be, or sort of the general political climate of the neighborhood. And I found that there was some interesting differences in terms of things like politics and perceptions of neighbors that I, you know, did not expect to find. And so certainly, I think, you know, children spend a lot of time in their neighborhood. They play basketball in the street, and they, you know, run around in the summer playing, you know, having water balloon fights and all these kinds of things. And so, you know, who you live near, I think, really matters, and particularly in sending messages to children about race and patterns that they notice in their own world.
We often hear people want to have a colorblind approach. I'm a colorblind parent. Does that stuff even work?
Well, it's true that a lot of parents in my study told me that it was really important to them to raise a child who is colorblind. But unfortunately, when I talk to the kids, these children are living in a society where race matters. They notice patterns around them. They notice patterns in who's our senators versus, you know, who they see on, you know, on TV when they watch the professional basketball. So they notice race. And so I think, you know, parents that are well-intentioned and, you know, don't want their children to be hateful or to, you know, have negative ideas about people that look differently than them, I think what they're failing to account for is the reality that children do notice race, and then they're very confused about why they can't talk about it. You know, parents kind of shushing their child when their child asks a question about race, you know, that's also sending a message to their children about race. So I think that no matter what parents think, at the end of the day, what my research shows, at least for the kids in my book, is that these children are thinking about race, and they do have ideas about race, you know, regardless of whether their parents take a colorblind approach or not.
I'm sure there must have been one or two times you were talking to a parent who was giving what they thought was a very reasonable argument, and you were going in your mind, my goodness, this is pretty racist.
Yeah, so one of the interesting things about doing ethnographic research is that you really want to understand how the people in your study are making sense of the world. So what I think about things is less important in this context, right? Like, so when I'm being a researcher, that's different than when I'm living my everyday life. And so it was more important for me to not focus on my own feelings and sort of centering myself, but instead trying to really understand from these parents' perspectives, you know, how they saw the world, how they made sense of parenting, how they made sense of their children, and thinking about race. But I kept a journal that was separate from my field notes where I documented some of these other kinds of reactions that you're kind of getting at. But I ultimately really tried to not let my own opinions, my own emotions influence the research. I really wanted to hear the parents in their own words.
I want to quickly go back to schools. Is there a difference between parents and children who attend public and private schools?
For the families in my research, I found that many of the children who attended private school had some pretty powerful ideas about themselves and their own position in society as a result of going to private school. So it's important to note that while many of these private schools offered some really amazing, you know, educational opportunities, small class sizes, really highly trained teachers, and so forth, you know, these children believed that they were more special, that they were smarter, that they were going to be a leader in the future, and they had a lot of negative things to say about the kids who attended public school in their own community. And I found that was really interesting. We have a lot of research about why parents make decisions about different schools, but we don't have very much research on what children who then attend those schools actually think about those choices. And so I was really excited in this project to access the kids' perspectives, and I think that some of the patterns are pretty striking.
How do you think this would have turned out differently, or would it have turned out differently, if you did this, say, in the Southwest or the Northeast?
That's a really great question. And I do think that place matters. Certainly my colleague, Erin Winkler, she has conducted a similar project with African-American children, and she talks a lot about the importance of place and how place can play a role in shaping how children learn about race and learn about inequality and so on. And so I absolutely think that place matters. I think some of the process aspect of my research, sort of how children are interpreting their social environment, I think the process would be likely to be very similar across different regions. But I think some of the dynamics within each place would shape how that process played out. For example, I live in Mississippi, and some of the dynamics that are at play in terms of even something like schooling and the choices around schooling are very different in a context that's more rural and has fewer options for parents than certainly where I conducted this research in the Midwest. So I absolutely think that place matters. Certainly the demographics of different regions are also important to consider. So absolutely, I think you're right. I think place does play a role.
Is there a next step to this research? Can you go a little further and maybe, add more places or different types of people?
So, yeah, absolutely. So I am actually conducting some research right now with one of my graduate students in Mississippi around this topic of white racial socialization and thinking about sort of what I was just mentioning, sort of the contextual differences. I'm also doing some research on children who are living in Massachusetts and children who are living in Mississippi in terms of what they think about the current political moment and sort of racism in the context of politics, which is turning, I haven't analyzed my data enough to have any good findings to share with you, but I can tell you that the interviews are really powerful and really interesting. So I'm trying to think about new directions. I'm also following up with the kids. So I went back and re-interviewed the children in my book when they were in high school, and I do hope to perhaps interview them again as they become adults.
I would certainly love to see the results of your research with the Mississippi-Massachusetts comparison. That sounds fascinating.
It's really interesting. I've just been so, I love interviewing kids, and it's been really powerful to sort of hear their perspectives.
So finally, what do you think? Are you hopeful?
Well, as I talk about in the book, it's not a particularly hopeful book. On the one hand, my findings show that we have this idea in our society that being a good parent means giving your child the best opportunities. And when you have a lot of economic privilege and a lot of racial privilege, you're able to use those resources in ways to really give your kids some advantages. And so, I don't really know how we will interrupt that sort of passing on of unfair advantages within families because of this idea that, being a good parent means giving your kid the best. On the other hand, though, I think it's important to note that a couple of the children in my study really were, and I'm sure they still are, doing really meaningful work in their schools, in their communities, even in their families, sort of challenging the way their parents are thinking about race and so forth. And so I think that there's some room for hope, but I think that, ultimately we're talking about structural inequality and how our society is organized, and I think that's a really big it's a big task to address. So, that's my best answer for that.
Trying to think of what some of those kids, if they're living in just extremely white neighborhoods, what could they do?
Sure. And I mean, I think what's interesting is that some of the parents are giving children access to different tools to sort of navigate the world. So unlike the parents that are colorblind, even for kids who are growing up in communities that are, or neighborhoods that are predominantly white, maybe they're within closer proximity to neighborhoods that are more diverse. Nonetheless, those kids are getting more access to, they're watching different television programs about like documentaries. Their parents are talking with them about the news. They're really engaging in some anti-racist work in their communities, partnering with other kids at their school to protest things that are going on. So, I do think that there's some examples of kids that are, even though they're growing up in neighborhoods that are predominantly white, there are other aspects of their life that give them opportunities to think more critically about race and racism.
Dr. Margaret Hagerman is an assistant professor of sociology at Mississippi State University. The name of her new book is White Kids, Growing Up with Privilege in a Racially Divided America. Still to come, some of those back-to-school supplies you're stuffing into book bags may have some unpleasant hidden surprises. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A consumer group says it's tested more than 24 school supplies and found some that contain hazardous chemicals. The U.S. Public Interest Research Group has published an online report on the results of lab tests the organization's done on popular school supplies, including markers, glues, three-ring binders, lunch boxes, and water bottles. The Best of Our Knowledge's Paul Tuthill spoke with Janet Dominitz, executive director of MassPIRG, the Massachusetts Public Interest Research Group.
So we shopped at stores all over the country, online and both in actual stores. And we found the good news is there are plenty of safe products to purchase for your children going back to school. But the bad news is there are several with toxic chemicals that we are wanting to alert parents to so that they don't purchase those. And they're not labeled, and so you need this guide and other information to inform your shopping.
And the guide is available where?
It's available online. Our website is www.masspirgedfund. So masspirgedfund.org. And it's right there on the homepage, and it includes photographs to help people recognize products, both the safe ones and the ones that we are recommending that you not purchase. And in fact, we've written to some of the retailers who offer these products, asking them to take them off the shelves.
What are some of the back to school supplies that you looked at that you tested?
So we looked at, for example, play school crayons, and they contain asbestos, which is not something you want your child exposed to. And, of course, you know, that's probably the last thing you're thinking when you take crayons off the shelves, that they might pose a danger to your child. But, in fact, this one brand, which, again, we elaborate on in the report, contains asbestos. Another surprising finding is there's a three-ring binder at some stores that contains high levels of something called phthalates, which is another toxin that you don't want to be exposed to, and you certainly don't want your children to be using every day. So those are just a couple of examples of the things that, you know, would probably be in most people's back-to-school supplies list, and we just want to raise a flag now.
The majority of the items that you tested, though, I assume passed. They're safe to buy.
Yes, there's definitely a number. We looked at, you know, 27 different common products, and the majority of them are safe, which is the good news, as I said at the top. But the bad news is there's a surprising number out there that are still, you know, that still pose a threat. And, you know, it's there's two issues. One is some of these items contain toxins that have already been ruled by the federal government as, you know, as unsafe. But then the other problem is there are a number of toxics which plenty of research shows children should not be exposed to, but the government has not yet banned. So we're trying to do some public education here as well, for people to get to know what those chemicals are and to, you know, keep them off, out of the shopping basket.
And so the advice you would give people who are going out to do their back-to-school shopping is what?
Well, there's three quick things. One is some of these products contain toxics that are banned, and, you know, we're calling for them to be taken off the shelves. The second thing that we're saying is some of these school products contain toxics that, while not banned by our federal government, have been researched thoroughly and pose a harm to children, which is why we're recommending that, you know, people look at our guide and go and pursue other resources, which is number three. You know, if you go to the Consumer Product Safety Commission website, www.recalls.org, you can be notified specifically about lead recalls, which is some other another problem that we found in some of these products. So you got to keep your eyes open. You have to be informed, and that's why we're putting out this guide to help people.
A spokeswoman for PlaySchool's parent company, Hasbro, told the Washington Post that a thorough investigation is being conducted into the claims that asbestos was found in the popular brand of crayons.
Janet Dominitz is the executive director of the MassPIRG Education Fund. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Paul Tuttle. Apparently, finding toxic materials can be as easy as digging in the dirt. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
On this Student Spotlight, kids love playing in the dirt, but can it be harmful? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Francisca Landes, graduate student in Earth and Environmental Sciences at Columbia University, warns danger can be just below their feet.
Have you ever tested the soil in your backyard for lead? Our lab has collected over 1,000 soil samples in New York City and Peru to analyze for the dangerous heavy metal. In many ways, reducing lead poisoning represents a major public health victory. Blood lead levels in the U.S. have continued to drop since the 1970s. However, new studies show that even low levels of exposure can reduce child IQ and learning ability. Children are the most at risk due to their stage of development, and they tend to be the most exposed by ingesting contaminated dust, soil, or even old paint chips when playing on the floor or putting objects in their mouth. Unfortunately, most people don't think to test their soil for lead. Especially in urban or historically industrial areas, soil can have high levels of lead. So what did we find when we tested New York City backyards? Over 80% of the soil samples in the neighborhoods we tested had levels above the federal soil lead hazard standard for bare soil where children play. These were higher than what we found in some mining-impacted communities in Peru, where only 10% of the home samples and 30% of all samples exceeded this limit. What's more, in New York, an astounding 35% of samples had lead levels more than three times this limit. Finding high levels of lead in soil is worrisome, but there is something you can do to protect yourself and your children. The best thing to do is to cover the contaminated soil and to ensure that your children can't play in or interact with it. And if your children need a place to dig, consider creating a sandbox. Also, be sure that your children always wash their hands before eating and that they don't stick dusty hands or toys in their mouth. And if you haven't yet, please consider testing your yard for lead.
That was Francisca Landes of Columbia University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.